Good evening. Welcome to the Simple Actions group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Graham Rutherford and I'm an alcoholic. And for those that would care to join us, let us open the meeting with a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The Simple Actions group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. Thank you so much for coming out on this Monday night to our home group and to help us with this supper and a speaker event. And hopefully the food was to your liking. It was really delicious. And thank you, everybody that brought some food, and to those of you that ate it. So the Simple Actions group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking, sorry. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. Remember, the person next to you might be listening to the speaker. Or they might be thinking about how they're doing. Anyway, this group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. And I'll now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So, as usual, we've spared no expense, and we brought Mr. Jerry all the way from Raleigh in North Carolina, which I think is a different state from here. I think it's south from here. And he drove all the way up here tonight to be with us. We had a little chat at dinner, and I think maybe we went to the same therapist, I don't know. But little Jerry and little Graham got acquainted, and I'm really looking forward to listening to what he's got to say tonight. So I won't take up any more of Jerry's time, and if you'd like to give him a round of applause, Jerry.
I'm Jerry Weaver, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 2nd, 1989. I have a home group. Home group is called There Is a Solution. We meet in Holly Springs, North Carolina, just outside of Raleigh, on Tuesday nights and Thursday nights at 7 o'clock. If you're ever in that area, come by and check us out. I also have a sponsor who has a sponsor, so on and so forth, and found that in order for me to stay sober and to grow spiritually, it's important to have a home group, a sponsor that I stay current with, and a sobriety date. A good therapist is always good, Graham. I appreciate you talking about that. I mean, when I got sober, that's all I thought I needed was a therapist and a little medication. I'd be in good shape. And maybe let my wife come back and let her stop sleeping with my cousin, and a job, and get a car, and everything would be all right. But anyway, I don't know why. They said that the book says that the main problem centers in your mind rather than your body. That's talking about the mental obsession, but I'd submit to you, even after you're sober, your main problems in your mind. I mean, my mind continues to tell me to do things I shouldn't do, say things I shouldn't say, like probably some of the things I just said a second ago. And then, it still just wants to continue to mess with me. I don't know if anybody else has that problem or not, but I used to, when I was drinking, I used to start fires. And this show you how your mind messes with you even in sobriety. So a couple of years ago in the area that I live in, there were people starting fires. There was like, it was all over the news, and there was every weekend somebody would burn a house down, or they burn a pile of stuff. And so there was this big investigation. I don't know, it's probably been at least 23 years since I had started a fire at that time, and I'm thinking in my mind, well, I wonder if they think it's me. You ever have that happen? I mean, like, wonder if they're suspecting me. And, I mean, I hadn't even come close to starting any fires, and then I wonder if I did it. And then it's like, crazy. It goes even more bizarre than that, but anyway, the good news is that on most days, my mind doesn't mess with me like that, because I'm a guy that as a result of taking some simple actions that are outlined in our literature, that I've recovered from that hopeless state of mind and body, and I've got a new mind that was given to me as a result of being a member of AA and taking some actions, and I don't suffer from alcoholism anymore. I'm certainly not cured of alcoholism, but I have recovered, and now I've had a vital spiritual experience, just like the literature talks about, and I've been given a sixth sense, and the problem for me has been removed. And I don't say that in any arrogant way. That's just what's happened to me as a result of taking the actions and taking the steps out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was told, actually the first day a guy made a 12-step call on me when I was sitting in a detox, that what we have in Alcoholics Anonymous can be permanent, and that I can recreate my life. And I'm not trying to remodel the old life or build on the old life or try to rearrange it to suit me, that I can absolutely recreate my life in Alcoholics Anonymous if my ideals are grounded in a power greater than myself. And man, when I was sitting in a detox, it just absolutely did not seem possible. I was sitting there, and I'd committed suicide 3 times and died twice, and my wife is gone, and she's sleeping with my cousin, and I got a pile of bills, and I've lost my house, and I don't have any vehicle, I don't have a car, and my life was over, I thought, and I was absolutely hopeless, and I was hopelessly defeated. And, you know, again, it looked to me like what I needed was a doctor and some medication. I needed somebody to give me a lot of money to pay my bills and to get people off my back. I needed somebody to give me a place to stay, give me a car, and then give me a job, and then let my wife come back so I don't have to deal with those abandonment issues. And everything would be okay. And it looks like that's what I needed. And, you know, I was told, hey, forget about all that stuff. And when you're sitting there in that condition, somebody's telling you to forget about all of it, it doesn't make much sense. And I was told that, hey, if you try to just lay all that stuff aside, you did a pretty poor job trying to arrange it and control it and focus on getting sober and trying to turn your life over to a power greater than yourself and try to focus on your spiritual dilemma instead of your material and physical dilemma, that everything else would follow. And I was the guy that was told that, you know, if you take care of your spiritual life, everything else follows that. And, you know, all I can tell you is that for some reason I had an open mind enough to believe what that guy was telling me was true, and enough willingness to do a few things that he suggested that I do. And my life, you know, started to change, and I was able to stay sober. I'm a guy that has been sober since his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the only reason I say that is because I was sober about 9 months, and I was going to a lot of meetings, and was actually feeling pretty good about what was going on with my life, and I'd go to these meetings and people would just be depressed and they'd be crying about their problems, and people would had been relapsing, you know, folks that I looked up to had relapsed, and I heard a guy say that how relapse had enhanced his sobriety, and I heard one guy say that relapse was a requirement. And I mean, I'm sitting there at about 9 months sober. I'm wondering if I've, you know, if I'm maybe there's something I'm not looking at or something. And by that time, I had already made a lot of amends and was sponsoring a person. And I started to wonder if you know, maybe I needed a relapse to enhance my sobriety. And I was at a meeting one night, but I really started thinking about it. I mean, it messed me up, and I started wondering why I was feeling okay and other people weren't, and why they were going back out and drinking. And I was in a meeting one night, and this guy named Tom I was the speaker. And I, at that time, I had never heard him speak, but when he got up behind the podium, there was something different about that guy than anyone else I'd seen. I mean, he was full of enthusiasm, and his eyes sparkled, and he was full of life. And the very first thing he said was that we had gotten sober in some ungodly year, 57, I think it was. I might have that wrong, Jim, I don't know, but 57 or 56. And anyway, he said that he'd been sober since his first meeting of AA, and that he talked about that what he found here was permanent, and that he, you know, he never had to drink again, and that was his experience, and that he, you know, he had been full of life and enthusiasm and enjoyed life ever since he'd gotten sober. And it shifted. I mean, it changed me and helped me to realize that I don't have to relapse, and that, you know, you can stay sober for the rest of your life, and that what we have here can be permanent. So the only reason I say that is that Alcoholics Anonymous has worked exceptionally well for me. And I started drinking when I was about 12 years old. And I grew up in a family. Actually, that's not true. That's a lie. So I can remember, alcohol changed my life at the age of 12 when I drank some old granddad. But I can remember being 5, 6, 7 years old and taking sips of my grandfather's or my dad's Pabst Blue Ribbon or Schaefer or whatever they were drinking at the time, Black Label. And I never felt any effect from it. It was just a little bit. I don't remember liking the taste of it. So I was a social drinker up to the age of 12. And I went into full-blown alcoholism, drinking old granddad. And I had a lot of reasons to not drink. I had seen what alcohol did to my family. Both my parents drank a lot. My grandparents drank a lot. One of my grandmothers was an alcoholic and had come into AA in the early 70s. So I had seen all that and seen the damage it did to people. And I can remember thinking as a young age, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to do that. And you know, my dad and my mom, they were big partiers. And they would have parties. And my dad, in the basement in the house that we lived in Springfield, Virginia, he had these black lights and these posters. And those posters would light up when it turned in black lights on. It had the velvet stuff on them, you know, and he had this bar with all this stuff. And I know now that my parents were pretty cool. And my dad had these pork chop sideburns and a big afro, and he had tattoos. And in the in the 60s and 70s, if you had tattoos, not everybody had tattoos back then like they do now. I mean, we got babies with tattoos nowadays. But you'd either been in prison or in the military, and he'd been in both. But he had this tattoo of this tiger right here, and this lion, devil, had this big old devil tattoo right here, which was kind of cool. And he had a picture, a tattoo up here that said, it was like a ribbon that said mom on it. And then over here he had another ribbon that had this lady's name on it that wasn't my mom's. And no one ever asked him who it was. But he was a cool dude. And they'd have these parties, and me and my brothers would be all excited about the parties when they first started. And then every time, I mean, it would turn into a fight. Somebody would mess with somebody's wife, or they'd fight over who was better, the Redskins or the Cowboys, and then they'd start, you know, guns might even go off in the house because of stuff like that. And I'd get scared, and, you know, somebody would leave, and the next thing you know, they'd be calling, and somebody'd have to go to the jail and pick them up, and the next morning we'd wake up and act like nothing happened. And so, I mean, I had seen that, and I just never thought I would drink after seeing stuff like that. And the next thing I know, I'm 12 years old, and I'm in the basement, and I'm drinking Old Granddad. And I had a spiritual experience that night. Because I was a guy that was full of fear and just felt different, felt like I should be on a different planet. And when I got that whiskey in me, all that stuff went away. I mean, it gave me I had a total rearrangement of the mind. I mean, all my feelings and emotions and ideas about myself and about life just drastically changed. And you know, I know today that's temporary. And that AA and God can make that permanent if I do certain things each day. But I had just a powerful experience that night with that whiskey. And the next morning I woke up in a pile of vomit. Couldn't remember everything that happened later on in the evening. And the first thought that came to my mind was, my God, I got to do it again, just as quick as I can. And the next day or 2 days later, me and this guy got drunk again. And the same thing happened. All that doubt, fear, and confusion about life disappeared. And alcohol, you know, made me feel like I was the man. And I just basically, I started to get into a lot of trouble. I was a chaotic, rebellious guy. And I just enjoyed getting into trouble. I was labeled a juvenile delinquent at the age of 13 by Fairfax, actually that was Stafford County. And I got caught in school. I was 13 years old, and I got caught in school with some Budweisers and a little bag of pot. And I'd quit telling this story, but anyway, me and these other guys had this deal. We were going to try to steal as much alcohol as we could from our parents and have a little party after school. And so I managed to get 3 Budweisers from my dad, and I carried them to school, and they were in the locker. And during the course of the day, this girl had this little cellophane bag of this pop, and I'm not going to give a drug talk, don't worry. And I had never smoked any pop at that time, but I'd watched my uncle smoke a lot of pop. He smoked it in the house. And I'm thinking, well, I'll be big and tough, and these guys, I'll get something. She asked me if I wanted it, and I was like, yeah, I'll take it. And I was going to show it to those guys after school. About 10 minutes before school was getting out, the vice principal comes into the class and says, I need to see Jerry Weaver. And my heart sank, and she's like, you got something you need to show me? And I was like, well, yeah. So I took her to the locker, and I gave her the Budweisers. I didn't tell her about the pop. And she saw the Budweiser, and she's like, that's not what she was looking for. She didn't even know about it. And so she said, you got something else? I'm like, no, that's all I got. So they tore the locker up, they searched me, they finally found it, and they take me in the office, and they call the police, they call my parents, and I don't know why, but for some reason, I didn't want my parents to know that I was going to actually smoke it. So they kept, like, interrogating me, asking me, well, where did I get it, how did I get it, and, you know, I wouldn't tell them anything, and I finally said, well, you know, I got it from somebody, my plan was to sell it. That was not smart. I've been way better off telling them I was going to smoke it. And that led to getting kicked out of Stafford County school system for life. They told me that I couldn't come back. And anyway, I went downhill from there. I continued to get into trouble and just continued to cause problems for people. And, you know, my parents had to actually, I got kicked out of 2 school systems. Literally, I mean, was asked not to come back, and which required a move on the family. And you know, when you're a teenager, you don't even think about any of that stuff. I mean, my whole family had to get up and move because I couldn't go to school. And I didn't even realize that until I got sober. But that's how we are. I mean, we're just absolutely completely absorbed with ourselves, and we don't think about how our actions impact others. And I continued just to get into trouble, and I got charged with assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill and assault on a police officer. And that's how I got into the military. They give you a choice. I was a guy, well, I won't go there, but I ended up going into the Air Force thinking that, my plan was that I'm going to get some education and get some discipline and my life's going to change. And I'm going to prove to people that I can do the right thing. And I had all these good intentions, but it was never followed up with any action. I got out of basic training, and the first thing I did was I went to the bar when I got to my first duty, and I got drunk, and I continued to drink. I started blacking out, and I remember where I woke up, and I'd wake up in places and not remember what happened the night before, and people would have to tell me what I did, and I'd go to bars with people and get in fights with the same people that I went to the bars with, and the next morning I wouldn't remember, and People that don't have blackouts don't believe you when you tell them that you don't remember what you did the night before. They just don't believe you. And I woke up. I was living up in Rantoul, Illinois, and I was up in tech school up there. And I lived in an all guys dorm, and we'd been in Champaign, Illinois, at the University of Illinois, partying, and somehow the next morning I woke up. Felt something cold, and I looked around. I was on the bathroom floor in this all men's dorm. It's not my bathroom. I look around, I'm dressed up in some women's clothes. I'm trying to figure out what happened. And it's one of those times where you're glad you had a blackout because you just don't want to know what happened. No one's ever made an amends to me for violating or anything like that. So. Figure I might have been, maybe I was modeling or something, I don't know. But things like that would happen, and I wouldn't think much about it. I thought everybody experienced stuff like that and had things like that happen. And I was a rebellious, chaotic guy that was absolutely just full of fear. And I would have never told you I was full of fear. I didn't play off like I was full of fear. But I was a guy that was just consumed with what was going to happen next and when they were going to come get me and what you thought about me. And my whole life and all my decisions were just governed by that. And the only thing that made that go away was drinking. And I would drink, and I was able to do things that I couldn't do before, prior to not drinking. And it was just an absolute solution for me for a long time. And I like drinking that. I don't know why I thought of this. You ever hear that statement that my worst day sober is better than my best day drinking? Well, that ain't true for me. I can guarantee you that ain't true. Heck, I had a couple days last week that were worse than some of my worst days drinking. I had some good times drinking. I enjoyed it. And I got married at a young age thinking that was going to fix me. And that didn't work. And I was a guy that just felt like if I had the right people in my life or had enough money or one day my ship's just going to come in, everything's going to be okay. And that's just living in a fantasy world. And what happened to me was family started putting pressure on me to quit drinking, especially after I got married. And it really started to escalate then. And I didn't think I had a problem. I thought if things got bad enough, I could control it on my own. And what happened, I always, around this time of the year, New Year's and January, I always reflect back like on my last New Year's drinking, which would have been a few months after people started pressuring me to quit. And I came to one morning, and I didn't come to, I had convinced these two guys in North Carolina to drive with me to Oxon Hill, Maryland to rob a guy. Now, it's about 320 miles from where we were at to Oxon Hill, Maryland to rob this guy that I know that, and anyway, we started driving. We got about 8 miles, and something happened to me. It was like my whole this darkness came over me and told me that Jerry, you need to do something about your life. You need to get serious about getting on with your life. And so I stopped at a convenience store and got on a payphone, and I. It was like the voice was just speaking to me to do something. And I called my brother, who had just recently gotten help in a church. And he told me that they were praying for me if I never needed any help to give him a call. And so I called him and I told him, like, man, I need some help bad. You know, I got to stop living this way. And he said, well, we've been expecting your call. Come on over and we'll take care of you. So anyway, I ditched those two guys. This was New Year's. It was January 1st, 1989. It was a Sunday morning, New Year's Day. I mean, that's just a great day to get your life in order, make some New Year's resolutions, and right, everything's going to just automatically get fixed for you. And I went over to my brother was at my mom's house, and I went over there, and he got me cleaned up, and I think he made me some coffee, and we talked, and he was getting ready to go off to church, and he said, well, come on, you're going to go to church with me. And so I was like, okay, well, I got cleaned up, and I got dressed up in some clothes that were there at the house, and I looked like an idiot. I put on this silk shirt with this big old collar on it, like old disco 70s shirt, and I had these old pants that were about 4 inches too short, and I rolled up in the church that morning with my brother, and looked like Pee Wee Herman coming up in there with a disco shirt on. And I think that's probably what they did. They looked at me and they're like, oh my God, well, we got a live one here. But they prayed with me, and I went up to the altar and did whatever it is that they did, and I got up there and cried in front of the whole congregation. I really wanted to change and get my life in order, and I left there that morning thinking that my life was just automatically going to get better. And that just by going to church that one day, kind of like a lot of people do with AA meetings, they think they can just come to an AA meeting and things are going to change. And if you just come to an AA meeting, things are probably just going to get worse. especially if you go to one where you got about 30 crack psychiatrists trying to tell you what to do. But I left there and I just thought that things were just automatically going to get better, and it didn't. 3 days later, I was right back drinking. And for the next 7 months, I just lived an absolutely chaotic, crazy life. I continued to go to church, and I'd go in there drunk and hungover, and then I started blaming them for all the things that were happening to me. And I would read these spiritual books and the Bible and the Daily Bread, and I'd carry a little New Testament around with me, a little pocket New Testament. I don't know if y'all have ever seen any of them, but I'd carry that around with me, and I thought that if people saw that they would think that I was doing the right thing, that I was a good guy, and every once in a while I'd pull it out at work and start reading it to people and telling them what they ought to probably be doing, and it was just crazy. And then I shaved my head, and I thought that was going to keep me sober. I worked with a guy that drank just like I did, and he shaved his head, and he came into work one morning and his head was shaved. I'm like, dude, what's up with your head? And he said that he had hooked up with his organization that believed that the problems of man stems from their hair. And it's a true story. And their program of action is when you shave off your hair, that signifies the old man dying, or your old ideas die, and that when your hair grows back, that you're reborn and you get a whole new way to live. And I was like, man, I need some of that. I went home and I shaved my head. And I guess I didn't do a good job of it, because my wife came home and she's like, what in the world is wrong with you? I guess I was kind of a little patchy or splotchy or whatever. She cleaned it up, and I'd gotten into a fight with a guy one night, and he, not long before that, and he cracked me in the head with this big hickory stick, and I had this fresh scar right here on my head, and I looked like Charles Manson coming into work the next morning. I had that shaved head, and I'm listening to gospel music in this 72 Volkswagen that's all beat up, and I got that New Testament in the front pocket. So I stayed sober for about 3 days on a shaved head. So I see some folks in here have tried it. It won't work long term. When the book talks about being in full flight from reality, and you know, the normal life, you know, don't know the truth from the false, and your life seems normal. I mean, that's kind of where I was at. I wouldn't say I knew it was normal, but I didn't know the truth from the false, for sure. and I was just in full flight from reality. I mean, I had no idea what was wrong with me, what the solution was. I went and saw a psychiatrist, and you know, I tried all kinds of ways. I had a lot of well-meaning people try to help me. I mean, my parents tried to help me, my wife's parents tried to help me, the chief of police, the town that we were in, tried to help me. I had a couple high school principals try to help me, and you know, the Harnett County deputy, the Harnett County sheriff tried to help me several times, and I mean, none of that stuff, you know, it just never worked, and there was no identification. I had a couple preachers help me. The preacher of that one church, I mean, he tried his best to help me. And there was no identification there with those folks. I know that today, that they didn't have a solution. They had, just go pray, or you don't believe hard enough, or, you know, just stay away from those guys, or, you know, come straight home from work. Yeah, just don't drink. Well, hell, if I could just don't drink, then, I mean, I wouldn't have a problem. And I got suicidal, and I literally had just given up on life. I mean, I thought I had tried everything to get my life in order and to quit drinking. And my second suicide attempt was looking back on what it was. It sounds dramatic now, but it really wasn't at the time. I had this dog that had mange, and the yeah, you can tell it's going to be funny. The vet, it will be. The vet gave us this poison to kill this mange on his dog. And it was in a little bottle, and the dog was all ate up with it. And I came home one night, and I had kind of been planning it out a little bit. I had this bright idea that if it kills mange, maybe it'll kill a man. And I pulled some of it into a pulled it up into a syringe, and I shot it up my arm. And laid down on the kitchen floor there in the house and went away from here for a little while. And now, I don't, really not trying to be dramatic. There wasn't anything dramatic about it at the time. I mean, I did that just as nonchalantly as I'd go back there and get a cup of coffee. I mean, there was no thought that maybe this isn't a good idea. There was no thought that maybe there's another way. I didn't make any phone calls to anybody. I didn't write any notes to anybody. I literally just wanted to die. And, you know, next thing I know, I'm in a hospital, and my dad's trying to hide it from the Air Force. So I'm in a civilian hospital under my brother's name. Yeah. And which was a whole nother dilemma and a whole nother story. I was in the hospital for 5 days. And I can remember just prior to getting discharged out of the hospital, having a discussion with my dad, there's no way I can go back to living that way after going through this experience. And I believed that. I mean, I really did not want to drink again. And I did not want to cause trouble for anybody. I hated what I was doing to my family. And I was out of the hospital about 3 days. And, you know, I'm driving home with that, still got that shaved head, that New Testament in my pocket, listening to that gospel music. And the thought comes to my mind that, Jerry, if you just drink some little 8-pack of Ponies, the little short 8-ounce Budweisers, I don't know if they make them anymore, instead of tall boys, that you should be okay, right? Small beers versus the big beers, I mean, it can't mess you up. So I remember stopping at the convenience store and buying an 8-pack of 8-ounce Budweisers and a Slim Jim to coat my stomach, and next thing you know, I'm off to the races, right? And all of the consequences that center around taking that first drink and all the pain and suffering that it caused me of being in the hospital from a suicide attempt for 5 days, all of the pain and suffering and just the complications it created for my family, having to deal with all that and hiding it from the Air Force. I mean, it was pretty traumatic. And none of that stuff is sufficient enough to prevent me from drinking again. And, you know, the book calls that plain insanity. Yeah, it calls it a strange mental blank spot, mental obsession. I didn't understand what was wrong with me. But I didn't want to drink, and I did. And that's alcoholism. And once I start, I can't stop. That's what separates me from a normal drinker. If I don't have that, I'm not an alcoholic. It's pretty clear in the literature. And anyway, what happened, I got discharged out of the Air Force, and I was living like an animal. House is dark. I'm getting ready to lose it. It's infested with fleas from the crazy old dogs we had in there, and I'm living in there, and attempted suicide one more time. I sucked on an exhaust pipe of a 1982 Grand Prix. I don't suggest that. The good news about the other one is I never had to mange after, so a benefit. And I still think, there's been no scientific proof, but I still think it's helped my skin and my hair as I've aged, as I get older. I think it's helped keep it intact a little bit. It's all right to laugh today. But I got through another suicide attempt, and I'm sitting there in the house, you know, after literally almost dying a third time too with the car in the garage and whatnot, and I'm sitting there just blaming other people still. And I can remember just having these thoughts, look at what y'all have done to me. Look at what you've done to me, and no one understands, and I was just misunderstood, and if y'all would just see things my way, and if she hadn't have done this, then this wouldn't have happened, and if they hadn't have done that, and the Air Force, it's just on and on and on and on. And it was a week or two after that, I was walking down the road, had left a guy's house, and was going to walk 8 miles to a grocery store to write a bad check. And something happened to me, something like it, like my whole life flashed before my eyes. And it wasn't a blinding light or burning bush experience. It was just a thought that I had just turned 22. My life shouldn't be ending, it should be starting. And I had experienced way more than anybody at that age should have to experience. And it was like these voices or thoughts came and said, hey, if you don't do something, you're not gonna make it. And I wanted to die, but I didn't want to die. I wanted to drink, didn't want to drink. And I was, I can remember saying two things out loud. I said, there's got to be something better than this. And then I said, God, please help me. And I had said, God, please help me a lot of times before that. As a matter of fact, looking back on it, I guess he helped me every time, because whatever the situation was, I got through it. Here I am. But I had said that a lot of times, and I don't know what happened, but all I can tell you is from that moment to this moment, I've been sober. And from that moment to this moment, I've gotten better. And I absolutely don't want to imply that my life has just been absolutely perfect and everything has been rosy and all that. That's not true. I mean, life is life, and if you can think about it, I basically have experienced it sober. But I've been able to get through all that sober and not drinking and focused on a solution. And so I've continued to grow and to get better ever since that moment. You don't hear that a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. All I can tell you is my experience. And something happened to me again. All this is hindsight, but it was like something came down and picked me up and just spun me around and put me on a different path. And I basically, something surrendered me. I didn't surrender. I don't have enough, I can't surrender. I don't have enough power to do that. But something surrendered me and changed me. And again, it was nothing at that moment that I felt or knew about. This is all hindsight. But I became willing to do anything anybody told me to do to prevent from living that way. And my mind opened up. I didn't even know this, but my mind opened up to hear some things. And, my plan was to go write the check, to get a little cash and then go get some whiskey and go back to Wayne's house. And the next thing I know, I'm sitting in a detox. And that's when a guy from Alcoholics Anonymous came in and talked to me, and he He came in, he sat down, and I'm not even sober at this point, really. I mean, I was tapering off. But it was a few hours after I had been admitted to the detox. And he came in and he started talking to me. And he did a few things different than anyone else had ever done. The first thing he did not do was he didn't come in and say, what do you think your problem is? I mean, you ever talk to me? I mean, I went to that psychiatrist and she says, well, what do you think your problem is? It's like, well, damn, if I knew what my problem was, I mean, why would I be here? It just doesn't make any sense. But he never asked me a question. He never told me what he thought I ought to be doing. He came in and he talked about himself. And he talked about how he drank, and he talked about things that happened to him, and he talked about how he felt. And he talked about how, you know, what alcohol did to him. And I had never heard anything like that before in my life. He had done some of the exact same things that I had done. I never would have told anybody about him, but he was sitting there disclosing this stuff to me. And there was an immediate identification with that guy that I never felt with anybody else. And I don't think AA is magical or mystical, but if there's any magic in AA, that, I guess that's where it would be, is when one alcoholic helps another alcoholic. And matter of fact, the book says that, you know, that a recovered alcoholic can get through to a drinking alcoholic when the wife and the family and the psychiatrist and the doctors can't, and that they can win our entire confidence. It says in an hour. I don't know why they would put that in there, but it didn't take an hour for that guy to have some confidence, build some confidence in me. And the book says until that understanding is reached, not much can be done for us. And I mean, what happened was that, I mean, that guy basically gave me hope, because he had been sober for several years at that time, and he was just like me, yet he was different, and that he had gotten sober and had been sober for a while. And my God, I couldn't imagine that. But it's the same guy that told me that you know, he helped me understand what alcoholism is, and that, you know, that once I start drinking, I can't stop. That only occurs in an alcoholic, that most people drink a few and they stop. And the worst part about all that is I got a mind that tells me it's okay to do it. And I'm a guy that I've never doubted that. I mean, I know that that's my experience. When I start drinking, there's just no telling what's going to happen. I can't stop. I mean, I may end up in South Beach, Florida tonight. I might end up with your wife. I might end up in bed with your husband. I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, there's just no telling what's going to happen. And that might last 2 days, it might last 2 weeks. It might, I mean, I would just kept going, and I just couldn't stop. And I know I've got that. I know even more today I've got it. That's me. And when it says we've lost a choice in drink, well, I understand that too. I don't have any choice. I don't have any more choice today than I did when I first got sober. I've lost that choice. If you give me the choice on whether I drink or not, guess what? I'll be drinking. And then he's also the same guy that told me that if I didn't find a power greater myself, I wasn't going to be able to stay sober. And he didn't sugarcoat that or try to skirt around it. Just point blank, just told me, Jerry, if you like me, you're not going to be able to stay sober unless you find God. And he said, the good news about that is you can have your own conception of God. And I wasn't a guy that had been burned on religion, or I had been to a bunch of crazy religious stuff, but I never knew if it was real or not, or if all, some of it seemed a little hokey and some of it didn't, some of it seemed real. But I was a guy that was just confused. And I just was confused about spiritual stuff. I was confused about religious stuff. I felt that I had lived such a dirty, rotten life that if there was a God, that God wouldn't want to have anything to do with me. And why would he want to deal with a piece of trash? And basically what happened was I was told that, hey, you can believe, you don't have to believe anything. You know, you just got to be willing to believe. But what happened was that he walked me back through my life and helped me to look at all the times that, you know, I should have died and I didn't. All the times that this chaotic stuff that we do, and I got through most of it pretty much unharmed, all the suicide attempts and other things. And he looked at me and said, well, yet here you are. You know, if it had been up to you, you'd be in prison or dead. I was like, well, yeah, that's right. But you're not in prison, you're not dead. So you think that there might have been a power that helped you get through that. And I conceded that. And he says, well, why don't you try to forget everything that you think you know about religion or about spiritual stuff, just temporarily for right now. Just try to lay all that stuff aside and just believe that whatever power got you through that chaotic life drinking, that that same power might help you get sober. And I was told to keep it simple, not to try to understand it. It doesn't say anything that you got to understand anything. That it says your own conception, however inadequate, is sufficient. It doesn't say anything about understanding anything. And I just went on that basic conception that power that helped me get through that chaotic life drinking might help me stay sober, and that power might care for me. And I was told that as I took those steps, that my own belief would come to me. That you can't have a belief or an understanding until you actually take some action and do it. And most of us nowadays want to try to analyze all that stuff up front and completely understand it before we do it. And you got to take actions to do that. And that's the same power that I turned my life over to. And this right here was at about 2 weeks sober. I did a third step, turned my life over to God, and was told I was told a few things like that my will was my thinking, and that my life was my actions. And I understood that. And I was told that, hey, you're crazy. You don't have a whole lot of control over your thoughts, but you do have some control over your actions. So you need to try to act right, regardless of what you're thinking. And if you don't know what to do, then you need to ask somebody. And that was a simple way for me to look at it. And that, you know, I thought that in my mind, I looked at the third step in the big book and it looked like some stuff I had tried in church. I'm like, whoa. What worried me about it was not the thing about God, but was it looked like I had to be perfect. And that's what I heard in those churches, was that, man, you got to be perfect. If not, he's going to come get you, right? I don't even know if they told me that. That's just kind of what I heard. And, you know, I was told that, and I smoked and cussed and, you know, did stuff. And they're like, well, hey, you don't have to, you know, it's not about being perfect. It's just about trying to do the next right thing. Most importantly, it is making a commitment to take steps 4 through 9. And I was told that if you want to know, the only evidence that you've actually started the third step is that you're actually writing a fourth step. And it was pointed out to me that the decision that I made, and I did the third step and I said a prayer, and it was pointed out to me again, this was 2 weeks sober, that third step decision can be permanent. That can absolutely be a permanent decision that you never have to take back unless you drink again. And that the way that you do that is you start the fourth step. And I can tell you, and I have a lot of people challenge me on that, but that's fine. I've never taken that decision back. I mean, this whole idea, I turned over my will and then I took it back. Turned it over and then I took it back. Well, that's fine. That's not been my experience. And I ain't going to say I haven't made some mistakes in my life. That's just life. But that decision to commit to God and to try to live this way of life, I've never taken that back. I've fallen short of it many times. But I've never taken that decision back. And I started writing a fourth step. And I wrote that fourth step out, and I did a fifth step at about 4 weeks sober. Sometimes in AA nowadays you got to apologize for all that, but that's just too quick. You might scare him off. All I can tell you is I've been sober ever since. And by writing that stuff out, that first fourth step, I've done some other inventory since then, but that first fourth step was just, it got at some resentments I had, especially at my dad, my mom, and my wife, and my cousin. And you know, both of them to this day still deny it, but I swear I think they were doing it. And you know, got a bunch of fear that I had, and some crazy conduct. And what happened to me was when I wrote that stuff out, I started to realize just how poor of a job I'd done running my life. And all the people that I had blamed stuff on had really done nothing but try to help me. And then I made decisions that caused almost everything that ever happened. And I'm a guy that's been able to, every resentment I've ever had, even ones that most people would say, well, you were a victim, I've been able to find a decision I made that caused it to happen. And all I can tell you, there's a lot of freedom in that. There's a lot of freedom in being able to say, hey, I know what I did to cause that, or I can see where I was wrong here. That takes all the other people out of it, and I can be completely free regardless of what you do or what those people do or they don't do. And that's what happened to me. When I shared that stuff with another person, I became free of it. And I started to walk away from it. And, you know, I know today that the purpose of that fourth and fifth step is to identify things that are inside me that block me off. And if I'm full of resentment, then I'm spiritually sick. And, you know, if I'm full of fear, then I'm not trusting in God. And if I continue to act out on crazy conduct, then what I'm saying is, God, I don't need you. I got this one here. So just, you know, leave me alone for a little while. And the purpose of that fourth and fifth step is to identify all that stuff and to get rid of it so that I can, so the insides of me can be free and that spirit of God that's inside of me can be awakened and come to life. And then I start acting different. I start thinking different. And I did that fifth step, I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks sober. And I had nowhere to live, no job, no car. Wife ain't coming back. And things started to happen. Somebody gave me a place to stay. My dad opened up his living room in his house, and him and his wife let me stay there. And she didn't like that too good because I'd stolen a car from her a few months before that. Guy took a risk on me and gave me a job. And I got active in Alcoholics Anonymous, started going to meetings, you know, had a sponsor, and was doing the right thing. I started making amends, 7, 8 weeks sober, and was told that if I wanted to stay sober, that's what I would do. That I had to stop looking over my back, I had to stop ducking and dodging people, and I went down to the courthouse and turned myself in, so there were some warrants down there, about 9 weeks sober. That didn't feel good, but I did it. Got through it, went and made arrangements on bad checks. I would want a big amends, financial amends. I made arrangements. It took me 10 years to pay the money back. Now these are things that when you first get sober, there are things that are in your life that you never think you're never gonna overcome. You're never gonna get over them. There's just hurdles that are just insurmountable. And by taking simple actions, and by listening to other people, and by doing things a little bit at a time, right, things just work out. And you know, I was kind of stark raving sober for several years. My wife first wife finally came back at about 9 months sober, and it didn't work out. We stayed together for a couple years, and it didn't work out. She found out she always knew it. It took me several years to figure out she liked other guys more than she liked me, and it took my spine. At 4 years, I guess 3 years sober, it took my sponsor and his sponsor both to basically attack me at a waffle shop one time to get me to understand that. Yeah, right. And then finally beat reality into me. And so anyway, I thank God for good sponsorship. Yeah, I went through an experience between 3 and 5 years sober. I went through a divorce, and I really didn't want that to happen. I wanted to continue to try to make a situation work out that just absolutely never could have worked out. And I'd started stealing money from work, which is never a good thing. But I justified it because I work hard and they don't pay me enough. And around that time, the first Gulf War had started and the economy was bad, and you know, I needed a little extra money to take care of bills and on and on and on. And, because of good sponsorship, I was able to get through that. I got through a divorce without any arguing or fighting. None at all. I mean, it just all worked out because of good sponsorship and good direction that I got. I went back to an employer that took a chance on me right when I first got sober and gave me a job, actually gave me part of the business, and you know, I started stealing. And I went back and made an amends to my employer and basically laid all the cards out on the table, what I'd done and how I did it, how much it was. And I mean, I did not want to do that. I absolutely just didn't want to do it. I didn't think it was the right thing. It was going to injure me. And my sponsor laughed at me when I told him that. And by this time, the wife was gone. I don't have any kids. Well, who's going to get harmed, Jerry? I said, well, I'm going to get harmed. They're going to fire me, and they're probably going to lock me up. Should have thought about that before you stole the money. And so anyway, I went and made an amends to my employer, and I tell you, that I was absolutely ready to get fired. I mean, I knew they were going to fire me for that, and I was prepared to go to jail. And you know, the book says that whatever situation, that we got to do something about it, and even if that means being turned over to the authorities. Nowadays, we want to give people a break on amends. Well, no, don't do that. If I've harmed you, or I've stole from you, or done, I owe you. And anyway, I laid it out, and God looks at me and he says, I really appreciate you telling me the truth. And I've been watching you for the last few years, and really admire what you're doing. And then he looked at me and says, I've been forgiven for worse. It was a lot of money. So I start thinking, well, what did he do? And then, he says, I've been forgiven for worse. The best thing I'm going to do is forget about this. And I'm like, man, I've lost 3 months worth of sleep over this. Now you want to forget about it? So anyway, I paid the money back because it wasn't mine to take. And I started to look at things. Something happened to me after kind of going through. I mean, I was in a pretty dark spot going through the divorce and just beating myself up with stealing money. And something happened to me where I truly knew that came to just absolutely believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is not something that I go to. I'd always known that, but it was different. That Alcoholics Anonymous is a way of life. And that if I practice Alcoholics Anonymous as a way of life, and if I take these spiritual principles and let them solve all of my problems, not just some of them, but all of them, that remarkable things happen. And I started to realize that, that I can remember telling Paige, my sponsor, when I got through both of those situations, and I told Paige, I was like, there's not much written in the big book on steps 6 and 7. And he said something to me, and it is to this day probably the most powerful thing that anybody's ever said to me. It absolutely changed the course of my life. And it's very simple. All he said was, he says, if there was more you could do, there'd be more written. And he said that your job is to be willing to change and to allow God, let God change you. And when I went through that whole situation and the world got real dark, and I would have told you that God abandoned me. And, how could God allow this relationship to be ruined? And why would God, make me poor so I had to steal money or whatever it is? But, you get a resentment at God and you get a resentment at principles and you don't think that they work for you. And the reality is that I got closer to God through that. And I started, when I got through and I looked and I kind of woke up, I realized that God was taking me through that the whole time, that God was there. I was the one that abandoned God. Luckily, I didn't drink through it. And that, when we're getting further away from God in our minds, we're actually probably getting a little closer to Him in our hearts. And I realized that basically because of fear, that I didn't let God take care of my finances. I didn't let God take care of my relationship. I give him the rest, but I want to take care of these two because, you know, I can do a little better job at them. And Paige asked me, says, well, so why are you limiting what God can do in your life? And basically that's what I was doing. And for me, it was a second step issue. I just didn't believe that God had something better for me in those areas. And what I realized was that when I started doing what I could do, that God would do what I can't. And that, you know, that step 6 and 7 are really about being completely done with whatever the defect is. And my experience is that when I'm truly ready, that God shows up and God heals me and God gives me the power to do the opposite of what I was doing. So, and I don't work on character defects. I practice trying to be principle-centered. I practice being honest. I practice being loving. I practice being tolerant. I practice giving. And that's what I was taught, and that's how I started to change. And then I started to realize that when I took that into all areas of my life, then remarkable things started happening. And I started to consciously take God with me everywhere I go. And that's what I was told, was that Alcoholics Anonymous is about forming, establishing a relationship with God. And that if we practice these steps in the right way, then we become conscious of the presence of God in our life. Meaning that I should be conscious of God and I should take God with me. And when I started taking God with me to work, meaning I show up on time and I work and I do stuff without being asked and I stay late and I don't steal money and I try to practice some traditions and bring about unity and listen to other people and not think I know everything. My God, things started to absolutely just skyrocket at work. And a company that I stole money from and basically started out sweeping floors, I became the president of. Not because of anything I've done that was good. They did not fire me. I have fired a lot of people for a lot less. Nowadays you have to. Back then you could get away with some stuff, I guess. And then when I started taking principles into my relationships with my family and in a relationship with a woman, I stayed single for a couple of years. And when I started practicing Alcoholics Anonymous in my relationships started to change. And it's not anything magical or mystical or anything that's even hard to do. It's real simple. You know, I try to take these principles and I try to take the idea and the concept of God into all of my affairs, and remarkable things happen. And I'm a guy today that's blessed beyond measure because of AA. I've been remarried now for about 18 years. I had an incredible 24-year career. Left there at the top of my game, and I own my own business now that me and my wife just run together. And me and my wife have an excellent relationship. I've never cussed at her. I've never raised my hand at her. I've never called her a nasty name. I did my first wife quite a bit. I killed that woman's spirit by the way that I treated her. And I've not done that today. That's not because of anything I've done. That's because Alcoholics Anonymous works. And I, most importantly, you know, because of a loving God, that you know, I have been awakened spiritually, and that just means I think different and I act different, and I've got a relationship with God, and that relationship makes me purposeful and useful, and that the most important thing that I can do today is to try to help somebody else. And that's the gift that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, is the ability to help other people. The book says we've recovered and been given the power to help other people. And I'm a guy that believes that. I don't think those are just words, that we can actually avert death and misery for people because we have a unique experience. And that unique experience is supposed to be shared with everybody. And you know, that's what I try to do the best that I can. I try to help other people. And I don't believe that Alcoholics Anonymous and my recovery is about me. that I don't believe in me and my recovery, and I don't think I got a disease that's out in the parking lot doing push-ups and all that stuff that you hear. And I don't think AA is a selfish program. I've never read that in the literature, and I would challenge anybody to find that in our literature. AA is not a selfish program. AA is an unselfish program. It's an altruistic program, meaning selfless regard for others. And, you know, I don't wake up each day now knowing what I'm supposed to do. I've been given purpose and meaning. And that my job in the morning to wake up is to make arrangements with God and to go try to help people. And now, obviously I work and, you know, I do other stuff, but my purpose today is to share the message of Alcoholics Anonymous with people that need it and want it. And when I do that, not only do I stay sober, but I'm given an incredibly blessed life. I mean, it gets better each and every day. And I'm given the ability to rise above my problems and to not let them dominate me like I used to. So I appreciate y'all listening to me. God bless you.
Thanks very much, Jerry, for coming out tonight and talking with us. We're going to pass the seventh tradition baskets. The seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It's both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and the GSO remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. The Simple Actions Group is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hand. Thank you. Is there anyone here in the first 30 days of sobriety that would like to introduce themselves? No? Okay. There is literature available over there on that table. There's flyers, meeting lists, and so forth. Please help yourself if you want to buy a book, see a home group member. And sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. And would anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise their hand. Thank you. And I'd just like to once again thank all the people that brought food tonight. And I'd also like to thank Jerry for coming all the way from Raleigh to talk for us. And we do regularly meet in this room at 7 o'clock. It's a step study meeting. If you've not been to it before, come along. We're starting step one next Monday night, and we'll go right through the 12 steps, and then we'll do this kind of event all over again. So please feel free to come and join us. And with that, I'll thank you all again for coming out. And for those that care to join us, we're going to close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. Thank you.
Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.